shortly. Okay, shortly after 5, so we'll call the meeting of the Historic Preservation Committee to order. And roll call. Jean Flatley. Josh Pasco. Lois Sabota. Barb Copperwood present. Bobby Fredericks is excused, and Steve Metzler will be joining us shortly.
Can't hear you.
Is it not on?
Can you put your mic right on?
Just yet. I'm talking really close.
Modify the agenda. I would like to move item number 7 to before the item number 6, if I could get a motion to modify the agenda.
Motion.
Motion made and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Approve the minutes from the October 23rd meeting. If everybody's had a chance to review the minutes. The only item that I noted that needed to be corrected was that Steve Metzler was listed as both present and excused.
How could that be?
So were you here, Steve?
Which was it? Were you at the last one?
I was present.
Okay. And for the record, Steve's joining the meeting. Are there any other changes that are needed to the minutes? If none, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting.
Motion.
Lois made the motion. Does anybody second that?
Second.
And Josh second. All in favor? Invite by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Carried. Announcement. I don't have any announcements. Do you have any announcements, Tracy?
I have a couple. I just want to double check with the board and committee. The last couple years, we've joined the National Alliance of Preservation Commissions. We've been a member of that organization, and they're the ones that send these magazines that we get all the time that we kind of pass out and everybody takes a look at. It's $50 a year. I just wanted to double check with you folks. We have access onto their website. We get a lot of good information from them, and just wanted to make sure that you would like to be a member again, because then I will be up our membership.
And I've read through some of the magazines, and I found that they're very informative, so I would be in favor of that.
And then I just bought some other documents that we do receive every year. Again, if you guys want to grab them, usually you guys take them and take a look at them. But there's some really good ones, again, from the Wisconsin Historical Society. They have these great magazines, which I've read a couple of them. There's some really good history in here. They also have a catalog of, you know, different historical books that they have that are very interesting as well. Their newsletter we always bring, and then this document that they put out is Preserving Wisconsin Civic Legacy, which kind of touches on municipal buildings and having them on the National Register and what it means. And it has examples, case studies of different communities that have done that and what the buildings are and different ideas and where they're at. So this I found interesting, especially with what's on the agenda tonight, number 7. So we do get a lot of good information. I know you guys take it and look at it, but I just wanted to revisit that as well and make sure you wanted to continue with all that.
I think they're all beneficial.
Okay. That is it for me.
Okay, and I do also just want to announce that Joe DeRose is joining us this evening to answer questions. And he came up from Madison and still has to make the trek home tonight. So we are hoping to wrap up the meeting around 6:30 so he can get home at a reasonable hour. Okay, number 5 on the agenda is public appearances. And if anybody would like to speak about items that are not on the agenda, if you could limit your comments to 5 minutes, and please approach the podium and state your name and address before you would speak. Yes.
I'm Jim O'Rourke, 2339 Oakwood Avenue. The Historic Alloy Society is on the contracting team that evaluated the intensive survey. And I just wanted to go on record that I didn't, I thought that this inviting Joe up was a bad idea. I had asked for a case study instead of a hearing and a rehashing of the December 2012 meeting that we had that went on for 3 hours. So I appeared here with some of my information, but again, I prefer just a case study and let a professional evaluate Alloway instead of going through this. Thanks.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to make any comments? Okay, then we'll proceed on to number 7, which has now been moved to number 6. And that is the presentation by Joe DeRose on National Register Designation for Municipal Buildings. And if you'll recall, we did apply for a grant to the State Historic Society to look at having the Village Community Center building on Webster, as well as the Water Department building on Green, listed with the National Registry. So we have not found out if we've received the grant yet, but Joe will answer any questions, if anybody has any, about being on the National Registry.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Joe DeRose. I work at the Wisconsin Historical Society in Madison, and I brought a packet of information to leave with you about the ramifications of having a property listed in the National Register when it's municipally owned. You did apply for the grant. It's going to be reviewed on February 28th. That's when the recommendation is made by the State Historic Preservation Review Board. It's a governor-appointed board that meets quarterly, and at their first meeting of the year, they review grant applications to approve or deny grant applications. So if you want to give me a buzz later on the afternoon of the 28th or on Monday, you can go right ahead and I can let you know what happened, what the outcome was. Like I said, I brought along a packet of information that spells out the requirements of the village when they have a property that they own that is listed in the State National Register of Historic Places. And let me just read from it real quickly here. It says, we have been advised that the village may be planning a project that may affect a property that is listed on the State Register or National Register. Pursuant to Wisconsin statutes, the village must submit to the Historical Society a project proposal describing the action that may affect the listed property for our review. We must determine whether the proposed project may adversely affect the listed property. If there is an adverse effect, we may require negotiation with the village to address the adverse effect in an effort to avoid, minimize, or mitigate that adverse effect. To determine whether a proposed action may affect a historic property that is listed in the register, the basic question to answer is, will the property itself or its setting be altered in any way? If you believe that this project may affect a listed property in any way, then the course is to send us this proposal. So I brought along the cover letter that spells out what you know, what I just read. The person that you talk with is Chip Brown of my office, and it has Chip's phone number on there. So if you have further questions, you should talk with him directly. He's the one that you'd be dealing with. I brought along a copy of the state statutes that are referenced in the cover letter that spell out the village's responsibilities. I brought along the form that gets submitted when you're proposing an undertaking that you think may affect the property, so that's here. The big thing to keep in mind is that when you propose work that you're going to be doing on a municipally owned property that's listed in the register, you have to work with my office. And the idea is to come to an agreement on what we're comfortable with that you're proposing for the building and what you're comfortable with. It's not a buck stops here type of approach. So anytime you're proposing work on it, you get in touch with us. If you're planning on selling the building to a private entity, a preservation easement has to be put on the property, and I brought samples of what those are. Basically, what it is spelling out how the building currently looks when that new buyer and that private individual buys the building, what the building looks like, what are the key features that are going to be preserved by that owner. So that's something that the village will be required to do. So I have copies of all of these things that I'll leave with you, Barb.
Sure.
And the big thing with this is to, you know, if you have questions about it, to give Chip a buzz. Mm-hmm. He's the one you need to talk with.
Okay, thank you.
Any other committee members have questions?
Yeah, the questions about that, I can't get into too many details because I'm not the one that administers that program, but at the risk of saying, call Chip anytime you ask a question, fire away.
Okay.
Okay. Question.
Okay,
if the building then gets designated historic under local designation.
Jim, we'd have to suspend the rules and decide because this is a. This isn't a question and answer portion.
Okay.
So we have to have a motion to open it up to the public. Anybody willing to make the motion? Then I guess. Anybody want to make a motion to suspend the rules and open this up to the public for comment?
Okay, I'll do it. I'll say that.
Okay. Jim will make the motion.
I'll second.
And Josh will second it. All in favor? If I by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Jim?
Once the property is designated historic and it is sold to somebody else who wants to renovate the property, but it's been designated as under the local designation by our Historic Preservation Committee, is there anything that the owner would have to do to go ahead and get the work done besides through you? For example, would he be fined up to $10,000 a day if he started to do work on the property that the committee decided they didn't want to see done?
Okay, there's as far as I can see, there's two questions there. First is, if the property is listed in the state and national register, this is the process that has to be followed. There's no fines for it. If it's listed under your local ordinance, I don't have any say in how your local ordinance is enforced. So if it's a local landmark under your local ordinance, you have to follow the procedures there for that. If it says there's fines, then there's fines. But, I mean, if it's locally designated under a local ordinance, those are the rules you follow. If it's listed in the state or national register of historic places, then these are the rules that have to be followed. Does that answer your question?
Correct. So there's no penalties with the state and federal. All the penalties and fines would come from the local designation.
That's as far as I know, yes.
So if it was locally designated, we would have the certificate of appropriateness.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. I know the board remembers when Heritage Health with the guardhouse, that's locally designated, that building, and then they wanted to do some work on it, so they had to go through the certificate of appropriateness, and we went out and toured the facility and the building inspector, and they had to get the building inspector and the building permit. So it would be a very similar process if there was a locally designated facility that we had and someone wanted to do some work on. It would come to you folks ahead of time. They have to fill out the form, and you would approve or disapprove of the work that was done on that building. We don't levy any fines. We don't have a charge for the permit. I think if you're a nonprofit, there's no charge. I think if you're a for-profit organization, then there is a slight cost. But otherwise, there are no fines or costs to go ahead and go through that. But we've gone through that once only. So.
And you can be on the National Register without being locally designated.
Correct.
Okay.
There are two separate processes.
Okay.
And for the board, can an owner opt out of being locally designated? This came up at the at one of our earlier meetings with the Fond du Lac person. I think a contractor said that there was an uproar over being locally designated because of the fines and all the teeth being in the local designation. So can a owner opt out of a local designation once the property has been designated historic?
I'll have to check the way the ordinance is written on that.
something we can look into.
Okay.
I don't need an answer to that, but
okay.
Something that the board should see.
Does that ever happen? Is that typical? That
well, as far as the certified local government program is concerned, which Alloway is a member of the certified local government program, there is no opt-out clause. Once a property is designated, it is designated. It can be undesignated if it's lost the characteristics for which it was listed, or if it's been demonstrated that there's an economic hardship when selling the process. But once a property is designated, it is designated. The property owner is, the commission is encouraged to be in touch with property owners about their intent to designate buildings up front. And typically there's an appeal process if they decide to go ahead and designate and the property owner is not interested. But if you do have an opt-out clause, that either has to be removed or you lose your certified local government status.
Okay. Check on that.
Now, you didn't have it when you first became a certified local government.
And we haven't changed our ordinance at all, so it shouldn't be there then.
There is no opt-out.
It wasn't in the original.
Right.
I think that we have probably the most stringent. All the communities around here are jealous of our ordinance because it's got all the teeth that people want. And that's kind of a little bit scary to some people.
Or is it just mirroring what the state basically...
Yeah.
Put forth,
but she has
all
the teeth. The state ordinance has all the teeth. Green Bay doesn't have the teeth, and Pier doesn't have the teeth. So.
Is there anything else, Jim?
That's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll resume the regular order of business. Any motion on that? No? Okay. And thank you for that information, and that'll take us to the question and answer session in regard to the architectural and historic intensive survey report. And if anybody had questions, if anybody had questions, we had asked that they submit those so that Joe would have a chance to do the research if it would be necessary to get us an answer. So I sent some questions to him. I think a couple other people did. So Joe, if you'd like to go through those questions that
yes,
we sent.
Thank you. What I'd first like to do is I'd like to go over kind of the process that the survey of Alloway was a part of. And then I would like to go into the questions that were sent to me and then answer any other ones that have popped up. A couple of years ago, the Village of Alloway applied for a grant to undertake an intensive survey of the community, of the village limits. As I mentioned previously, Alloway is a certified local government. My office is largely federally funded, and we're required by law to pass through 10% of our federal funding to certified local governments in the form of grants. And that's what we did. We funded the application. The important thing to remember with these surveys are that they follow the standards of the National Park Service and of our office at the Wisconsin Historical Society. The main emphasis of these surveys is to identify properties that are eligible for listing in the National Register of Historic Places. That is the primary focus of these surveys. They get used for a variety of other purposes, but first and foremost is to identify properties for listing in the National Register. The National Register is the country's official list of significant properties. For a property to be put on the National Register, it has to be at least 50 years old. That's kind of the minimum threshold. Has to be at least 50 years old. It has to be significant for one of four different reasons. It can be significant for its history. It can be significant for its association with an important person. It can be significant for its architectural makeup, or it can be archaeologically significant. This survey did not deal with archaeological resources. It just dealt with above ground resources. Property has to be at least 50 years old, has to be significant, and it has to have historic integrity. That's a fancy way of saying, would the original owner, if they came back to life, would they still recognize the property? So this survey didn't look at every building in town. It didn't look at every building that was 50 years old. It looked at buildings that were able to help them evaluate the architectural significance of properties. There's really no reason to take pictures of hundreds and hundreds of colonial revival buildings to say something significant as an example of the style. After you've looked at a few dozen of them, it's pretty easy to identify which are the ones that rise to the surface. And that's what the survey does. This survey looked at over 780 buildings in town. It identified 13 as being individually eligible for listing in the National Register, and identified three potential historic districts, identifying about 113 buildings in those districts. So the survey was done to identify properties for listing in the National Register. It was done to the standards that have been developed by my office and approved by the National Park Service. That's where the funding comes from. We have funded 101 surveys such as this around the state of Wisconsin since the late 1970s. All of them have been approved by the National Park Service. We've been held up as one of the best at what we do in the country. We have listed, over 2,000 individual properties on the National Register of Historic Places. We have listed over 370 historic districts on the National Register of Historic Places. In my time with the state since 1990, we've had one building that was overturned. So to say we have a very good track record at administering the National Register and the survey program is a bit of an understatement. The survey, I've been doing this work for 30 years in Michigan, Illinois, Arkansas, and Wisconsin. And I have found that when you do a survey, you're lucky if you get about 10% of the buildings you survey eligible for the National Register. In Alloway, we surveyed over 780. We found 126 of those to be eligible for the National Register, either in districts or by themselves. That's 16% of what was surveyed. It's pretty good. Did the survey look at every old building in town? No, it did not. You look at the abstract, it says that, it points on page 2, it points out why we do these surveys. It provides a historical context for the evaluation of historic resources and serves as a means for identifying significant properties eligible for listing in the National Register. That's the focus of it. Again, on page 5 in the introduction, the major objective of the project was to identify structures eligible for the National Register. I mean, it's very clear why this was done. This is so with the National Register, if buildings have been demolished or altered, they're not going to be addressed in this. This survey report deals with buildings that are still there as of the time of the survey, the ones that meet the National Register criteria. Important to remember that this is not a static document. It's not carved in stone, never to be changed. Shortly after the last meeting, the wrap-up meeting we had, I had somebody get in touch with me that was a descendant of Mr. Ed Beeble. I hope I pronounced that correctly. She had said that this relative constructed many buildings in town, and she had the documentation to back it up. So I said, send it to me. She did. It's now part of the report. That's what happens with these things. As long as there's documentation to back the information up, I'm going to add it to the report. This document has pages of bibliography. A lot of research went into this. That's not to say that every available source was looked at. This project had to be wrapped up in less than a year. So undoubtedly, there were other sources that are available. Rita handed me a map today that she thought the Historical Society should have. I'll bring that back and give it to our archives. You know, any other information that comes to light, you know, we will add it to the document. Okay, so then the questions that I got. I had a few questions that were sent to me. Barb sent me a few that were passed on by either Jim O'Rourke or by Rita Houston sent me some. And I'd like to just go over these questions now. There was a question about, it says, there is still some confusion on the purpose of the survey. People feel that if a building is old, not necessarily historically intact, or has a great story connected to it, then it should be included in the intensive survey.
Can you identify who wrote the question so we know?
This came from Barb. It said that that both you and Rita had felt that if a building is old, not necessarily historically intact, or has a great story connected to it, that it should be included in the intensive survey. It's important to remember where the money comes for this survey and what the focus is. Focus comes for the National Park Service. It's to identify properties that are eligible for the National Register. So if a building that lacks historic integrity, even if it has a great story behind it, it's not going to be eligible for the National Register. That doesn't mean that that story isn't important. It doesn't mean that that story shouldn't be told. It's just that the National Register is not the vehicle to do it. Articles in the local paper, information on the local website, historic markers, plaques, these are all great ways to get these important stories out. It's just that the National Register is not the tool in those instances. The next paragraph goes on. One large concern that Jim and Rita have is that the Sunlight Park subdivision is not identified as being eligible as a historic district. I drove up earlier today, and I drove through the neighborhood, and I was able to agree why it was not found to be eligible for the National Register. It is a very nice neighborhood with many nice homes, but it lacks the significant concentration of historic resources. The National Register program is made up of dozens and dozens of bulletins that used to be in paper form, but they're all online now. And I have a copy of their website. This is a quote from National Register Bulletin 15 talking about how to define historic properties. Now, this is from the National Park Service. It defines a historic district as possessing a significant concentration, linkage, or continuity of sites, buildings, structures, or objects united historically or aesthetically by plan or physical development. When I was going through the Sunlight Park subdivision, I saw very nice homes, but then I saw many modern homes or buildings that had artificial siding to it. When you go into a historic district, it should be a concentration, like the Park Service says, a significant concentration. I had a map that I drew up while I was, I think I left it back on the table there. When I was driving through the neighborhood, I'd see three or four very good buildings on one side of the street, but on the other side of the street, maybe just one or two that met the National Register standards. Across the street, there'd be a couple of buildings. Oh, starting from Riverside Drive, I was driving east on Arrowhead, and on the north side of the street, there were four buildings that would that could be a part of the district. On the other side of the street, only two of the four. The next block, only one of the four would be contributing part of a historic district. And that's how that whole neighborhood was set up. It's very nice buildings, but it lacks that significant concentration. The historic districts that were identified in the survey, such as the Miramar Drive residential neighborhood, there's 26 buildings there. 23 of them would contribute to the significance of that district. There's only three buildings out of those 26 that don't contribute to the significance of the district. That's a significant concentration. You go to the...
Would you get all those streets?
Yeah.
Like Miramar, West Mission?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I drove through the different neighborhoods. Because I was asked, you know, to take a look at them, and I agree with the findings of the survey. The proposed Robinson Hill Historic District, there's 84 buildings in the boundaries of Robinson Hill. 74 of these contribute to the significance of the district. Only 10 of them do not. The ones that do not are either modern or they have alterations to them. That's a significant concentration. The final district that they found was Sunset Circle Residential District, and there's 16 buildings there. Probably 15 of them contribute. It says a building built in 1987 contributes. That may not be correct. That could be a typo, or it could be, the thing to remember with these surveys is, we expect these findings to be good for 15 years after the survey is completed. So a building built in 1987, 15 years after 2013, we're dealing with a building that's now 43 years old, might be contributing at that point. So those are, you know, those districts we felt were eligible. The one that I drove this morning that was in question, I've got the name of it already, on Arrowhead and Riverside Drive, that didn't have that type of concentration. It had very nice houses, but a lot of them were modern in there. You know, you might have had a 60-40 historic to non-historic buildings, and that's not good enough for the National Register. That's not to say that neighborhood couldn't be identified as a local historic district under your local ordinance. That's outside the purview of the project that was funded.
Okay, we have a question, Steve?
Mr. DeRose, I'm confused about the terminology of contributing to the significance of a district. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that each of the houses individually would meet all the criteria for the registry, is that correct?
There's in historic districts, there's two classifications of buildings, ones that contribute to the significance of the district and then non-contributing elements. The contributing ones mean that the district is significant as a whole. So those contributing buildings help tell us that story on why that neighborhood is significant. The non-contributing elements are buildings that are either modern, you know, buildings in the last 10 or 15 years, or buildings that have been so substantially altered that they no longer reflect the era in which they were built. So that's the classification of it.
Then the buildings that contribute to the significance, mm-hmm. do they, each building, does it individually meet the criteria for the registry of being 50 years old, having historical significance? You mentioned four different
mm-hmm. architectural.
Not by themselves, but as part of the collective whole. It's the district that meets the requirements of the National Register. That whole neighborhood is significant. The individual houses, they may be nice examples of a style, but they're not individually eligible for listing in the register.
But the district, whether something is a district, depends on the houses. And then the houses need to contribute to the district. I mean, one's got to come first. I'm not
sure. Okay, well,
you have houses that individually might not meet the registry in and of themselves, but there's something about them, and then collectively they all have something together that would make it
For example, the Robinson Hill District, it's identified as being eligible for the National Register because it's a good collection of buildings constructed between 1910 and 1942. So it talks about the buildings that are in that district are examples of the styles that were popular during that time period. So the ones that contribute were built between 1910 and 1942. To help us understand why that neighborhood is important. The ones that were identified as non-contributing were either built before 1910 or after 1942. They don't help us understand that story of that time period.
So the houses that you found on Arrowhead, where you said there was two out of four on one side of the street and one out of two on the next block, was about 50%. What out of four of the houses did what?
Well, when I was driving through the area, you know, like Robinson Hill has a period when the bulk of the buildings were constructed. When I was driving around the down Arrowhead and St. Francis, pardon my ignorance with those street names, I saw buildings constructed, some in the 30s and 40s, and then some looked like they were built within the last 15, 20 years, 30 years. I didn't see a real cohesive concentration of buildings from a certain period. You would have some colonial revival buildings that looked like they were built in the 30s, and then you would have a sprawling ranch house that was... Yeah, it was very, very contemporary.
So there has to be sort of a theme that holds together the district.
There should be.
Then you count the number of houses that sort of meet or conform to that theme. And if you have a minority of houses that would contribute to whatever theme is in that area, then you really don't have a district.
Exactly. I mean, that's what you're trying to find. It's a cohesive concentration. What is tying all these together? And when I was there, it seemed like it was a lot of upscale houses, but a very large percent of them look to be fairly recent. In the 50 years of the National Register uses as historic, it looked like a lot of those buildings weren't 50 years old yet. So that neighborhood, when I was driving around in it, I was talking to Tracy earlier, you know, when the next time the survey gets updated, that neighborhood should be looked at again, because all of those buildings that are built in, you know, the 1960s, 1970s, or later, they're only 50 years old. And now you're going to have, you know, all those blocks are all going to have buildings that are over 50 years old. And it may be significant at that point. But right now, it's the bulk of the buildings, I shouldn't say the bulk, a large percentage of the buildings are too new. And then you throw a few that have been altered.
I have to use a style of house, even if it was built, let's say it was built 40 years ago, but it fits the style with the surrounding houses that are all the exact same style. Would there then be a theme?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So it could be style, it could be year constructed, it could be...
It could
there's
be.
There's got to be some cohesive theme that holds together this district.
Exactly.
And you didn't see that on Arrowhead?
No. Okay. No.
Joel, I really have to disagree, because I live near the reformatory and I watched all those houses go up. And Arrowhead and St. Francis were the nucleus. Katie Barnard built all those houses. They were ahead of their times, but there are no new houses on St. Francis or Arrowhead. They are old. And we could see right down to De Vera, really, because it was so clear. Those houses are old. They are almost as old as what you call Robinson Hill. You go on Robinson Hill or Alloway Terrace and you see many unattached garages. Arrowhead and St. Francis were ahead of their times. I don't know of any aluminum siding. Do you, Gene? On Arrowhead or St. Francis?
Yeah, so I saw a few, and I saw some that looked extremely modern. I'm not saying all
of them. Oh my gosh, there's one there that was modern. George and Mary Ellen Adel's house. It's modern for today. But it was there. George and Mary Nella are no long gone, but it was there when I was a kid. Those houses on Arrowhead and St. Francis are old. It took off so greatly that all the rest of the lots were sold very quickly, and that's how the rest of Sunlight Park developed. But Arrowhead and St. Francis are old.
Well,
I babysat there, so they gotta be old.
Yeah, like I said, old's one thing. It has to be significant as another. And, you know, when I was going through it today, I was like, yeah, they're very nice houses here, but I didn't see a significant...
Don't the people that live in those houses also contribute?
They would have to be significant. Again,
people were very significant.
They would have to, you know, it would have to be demonstrated that, you know, they were. And this is going back to the National Register criteria. They would have to be significant for the works that they did.
They would be significant.
Well, that needs to, you know, send me the documentation. I'll take a look at it again. Based on what we have, we didn't see.
You know,
that.
I look at Sunset Park, which was not there. It's not notable because of Lombardi. It is notable because Judge Doty lived there.
Well, we could,
the house is gone, of course. Mm-hmm. But why, I can't figure out why Sunset Circle would be, it wasn't even there when I was a kid.
I think that was, let me take a look.
There was another question that I had.
Rita, I've been preparing very hard for this meeting. And I talked with you extensively about this, so I'm prepared to have. I have about six topics that I can address that will get us back on track.
Jim, the questions are to be directed to Joe. Yeah. Is the question answer session or to the board, the peer, the committee?
Sunset Circle Historic District was identified as it's a well-defined cluster of 16 individual residences. When you go to that neighborhood, it's both sides of the street, very small area. Yes, Lombardi lived there, but the focus of it is that the buildings were constructed between the 30s, late 30s, going into the 60s and early 70s. When you go into that neighborhood, you get a sense that you're going back in time. There's been little, if any, alterations to any of the buildings in there. That's why it was identified as a historic district.
Maybe two houses, they were not there. I know the man that developed the property. And he bought all that property in 1935, developed it in 1965. I disagree. I know they put a lot of work into this, but I give the notable people and the sports people. My dad did a major of the landscaping in Sunset Park, and we had to water a lot of the yards for him. But those houses in Sunset Park can't compare in age, maybe distinction, yes, but they can't compare age-wise with Sunlight Park.
It doesn't have to be, you know. It doesn't have to be a contest between the areas. It's, you know, does it look like a cohesive neighborhood? Yes or no. That's what we're looking at. As far as the notable people, you know, it has to be identified that the vast majority played a prominent role in the history of the community, and we run into this a lot of times in Milwaukee. With buildings that were second and third generation, the families were important, but the people associated with the buildings that are there now, they were just carrying on the name. They were not the people that were significant in the history of the community.
Well, I'm just looking too at the notable people that I did, and I was happy with them putting in all the older shantytown people. But when they inject a few that shouldn't be in,
Well, the important thing is, the question is, are there resources associated with these significant people that you know of?
Okay, now let's take Don Schneider. I put him as a notable person. He took a company. My husband hunted with his father. He had two or three trucks. Don Schneider, who lives on Sunset Circle, was the one that developed the big Schneider. It's a national company. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, why is his brother listed?
Well, the question, as far as the National Register is concerned, is the questions that would be asked for Don Schneider are, okay, he started this important trucking company. Where was that? Where were the offices for that? Because that's, you know, unless
where
he ran
the
company, where are the offices? Unless he ran the company out of his home, the National Register is looking to identify the properties most closely associated with that important person. And if you're saying it's a captain of industry, if you will, then it's that industrial site. It's the corporate office that is the property that's most closely associated with that significant person.
They're located in Ashwaubenon. Mm-hmm. But why is his brother a notable person?
His house was identified as being, it's very unique. I don't know that it was individually eligible, but would that be why the brother was mentioned, because his house is mentioned?
As a notable person, probably not. Probably for historical, but I'd have to take a look at it. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that.
Maybe we can get, there's a big interview that was done on that house, and the tour was done, and we can't find the notes from that tour, but a tour was done of that house that was built in the 90s, and that would be worthwhile.
Was the tour done by Legacy?
Yeah.
And me.
Oh, you did tour it? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do what?
Can you use my performance?
So, we don't know where those notes are, but those notes are something. While we're talking about the Lombardi district, on Sunset, just wanted to make sure that we're on the same page, that all of the homes. First of all, that there wasn't a typographic error. I've requested the field notes from the survey. I got some of the field notes to make sure that what was handwritten, and when they went through with Jim Drager, that what actually ended up in the report was actually in the field notes, written down on the field notes. So the field notes said that all 16 properties located in there should have been included. My question is, let's say out of the 16 that they identified, that they flat out made a mistake on six of them, and for some reason you've only made one mistake out of the last 100, you got six mistakes in this one subdivision of 16 homes.
Well, when I said one, that was National Register nominations that have gone forward that disagreed with us. It was not survey findings. And again, I have also said that if you have documentation for anything, it needs to come to us, and we'll revise the report if we agree with the findings. That's the important thing to remember with this. Like when the information on Beeble Construction was sent to me, it was documented, I added it to the report. As far as the building being built in 1987 being a contributing element, remember that these surveys are around for at least 15 years before they get updated. If a nomination goes forward 15 years down the road, that building's now 30, 40 years old. And we've had cases where we've had contributing elements in historic buildings being of that vintage. So, like right now, if we were listing that district, that 1987 building wouldn't be old enough, so we would probably make it non-contributing at this point.
Well, let me just ask you one question. And just humor me. If for some reason, somebody wanted to contaminate your database and put in contributing labeled properties that weren't contributing as contributing, if a contractor actually did that, and if a contractor actually knew that what they were telling you was wrong, what would be the implication for that?
The contractors that have access to our database, we provide training for them, and then we also, I go over the findings of that. I go over them with Jim Drager as well. We're human. We make mistakes, and we correct those as soon as possible. Nothing's come to my office yet that shows that any of this information is incorrect as far as the National Register is concerned. So if that information is provided, we will take a look at it. Any of the surveys that we've done, people send us information, and if we we find it that it makes a property contributing or eligible for the National Register, we change the survey findings.
Okay, so we went through this for 3 hours in 2012, and the question that I have is, let's say, for example, the contractor knew that while they were filling out the form that there's a form that needs to be sent to Washington, D.C. that says that the State Historic Preservation Officer has reviewed the information, has approved it, and has signed off on it, and that he believes it's historically accurate. So let's take these 16 homes in Sunset Park. And if we wanted to nominate those 16 homes this year, would the State Historic Preservation Officer feel comfortable signing the form that goes to Washington, D.C. that says that that's a legitimate historic district and the 16 homes that were nominated, or call it 15, should actually be nominated, or would it need to be come out and be reviewed? Because there's 6 mistakes in there.
Well, until those 6 mistakes are sent to me with documentation, I have to go with what's in the report.
So Jim and the contractor would stand behind the existing survey, and for the past year they've been calling me names and saying horrible things, and I'm standing by what I said a year ago, and I'm standing by what I'm saying today, is that they contaminated your database and they did it on purpose.
I disagree. So that's where it's at.
But if you have the documentation, Jim.
What I'm going to want to do is share with Steve the documentation that I have.
Okay.
So that's on, here's the documentation on Sunset Circle. The Sunset Circle was so darn easy. That took me 12 minutes to review and spot that there were mistakes. So that was darn easy to do. So there's that one. And in doing so, you mentioned that I think that there were 780 properties that were reviewed. And we had requested the contractor. I provided them with the initial database of all the properties because I'm very interested in our historic housing stock. So I happen to have the database of all the properties with all the construction type and the year built and everything. So I gave them my list of 5,000 homes with the addresses, year built, construction, siding, everything on it. All we needed for them to do was drive by the property, list the style that they had, because we had lots of two stories and ranches, just list the style and whether it might be potentially eligible. So we asked them to evaluate 5,000 properties just on a drive-by and just mark down which ones might be potentially eligible, and they didn't do that. In fact, they evaluated, out of the 5,000 properties, there's 2,500 that should have had field notes put on them because they were potentially eligible, because those 2,500 were 50 years old or older. So there were 2,500 properties, and each year another 100 properties get added because of the aging housing stock, but there were 2,500 properties that we needed evaluated, and they actually evaluated, because I have the field notes, the typed up field notes, there were 925 properties evaluated. So we had to have 2,500 evaluated, and they only documented 2,925, so they did less than half of what we asked them to do. And in addition to that, of the 9.5 they evaluated, there's a couple hundred that are now missing. So, and I know that because of the numbering system that they used when they were using their field notes from when the data was actually entered into your database. So I have a list of, you know, the numbering system from the 925 properties, and we had actually asked them to do 2,500. So they did less than half of what we asked them to do, the minimum. And they will not provide us with the field notes that say they actually drove by and decided whether those properties might be potentially eligible. And I've driven by some of the other properties, and there should at least be field notes on them, but there's no record that they even considered them.
Jim, when you say that we asked them for 2,500 to be evaluated, was that in their interview, or is that part of a contract, or was there anything written down?
Yes, that was during the interview process. When we were down at Archetype, we went through. They were very impressed with the fact that we had provided them with the summary by decade of the of the different properties. So I told them at that interview that there were the 5,000 properties, and they saw that because that made it from Bobby, made it into the request. And out of the 5,000, there were 2,500 properties clearly potentially eligible, of which they only have a record of looking at 920 some odd, and so they did less than half of what we really wanted.
Who said they're potentially eligible? 50 years is the minimum requirement for listing on the National Register. It does not mean they're individually eligible. The work plan that I drew up for them required them to drive every street in the village limits and document buildings that are significant according to the National Register standards. Even in the largest of cities, we don't document 2,500 buildings, because remember, the idea is to identify properties that are eligible for listing in the National Register. Looking at 5,000 Colonial Revival houses is not going to help you develop a context for which are the most significant ones. So they don't document every single building over 50 years old. They document the ones that help them develop a context with which to evaluate the significance of resources. But yes, they did drive every street in the village. We don't ask them to clutter the database with buildings that don't add to our knowledge of historic resources. As far as a numbering system, I'd have to take a look at that and see what the numbering system is. If it's taken from our database, I know that our database for a while was only numbering every 20th record, which we've since fixed that. So the numbering system shouldn't be taken as a definitive number for how many buildings are in our database.
A couple things, because I graduated from the University of Wisconsin through the real estate program, and I went through that program in the agricultural school, but still through the real estate program under Dr. Braskamp, and that's where I learned how to do case studies. And the first case study I did when I was in the university was on the history of the commercial buildings in Chicago. So I learned how to do it under the University of Wisconsin program, and I still have the damn books from 30 years ago. So I dug it out, and I'm on track with this stuff. So I documented it. Now, what I was able to do, and I did have surveying classes. I did have actual physical surveying classes. That's how I know about field notes. So what I did was I looked at the field notes, I looked at the numbering system, and I noticed that there was a, that they went back to the Lombardi district. And I love the Lombardi story. We love the Lombardi story. It's just about ready to be told. In a couple more years, it'll be ready to be told, because then it'll be 50 years old. But I looked at the Sunset Park system. I looked at the numbering system when they initially drove through. I looked at the field notes. I looked at their maps. They came up with a new numbering system to add more properties to the Lombardi system after they were done with their initial drive-by. Those numbers are in different colors and out of sequence with what their initial impact evaluation of that property was. Same thing on the Robinson Hill property. Rita's been told, and we've been told, because Rita had a favorite property called the Quatzo property that we really like, that it will never be on because it's got vinyl siding. Well, I looked back from their field notes, and all of the properties that they added on in their second tour through the property, through the districts, they started adding on a lot of properties with a lot of vinyl on it. Because that's right on the sheet here, and I have that for it. And I'll give all my information to Steve, and then Steve can make copies and get them to you. But I sorted out so everybody can see that on the second drive through, that they started adding lots of property with vinyl and declaring properties that shouldn't be contributing as contributing. And I don't know why. I'm not going to speculate why, but they contaminated your database. Did it
I wish you would stop using that term, Jim.
I understand that. You see, but I'm not, and my feeling is that, and I've researched to make sure that I'm accurate. And I understand the concept of edge. Okay? In historic districts, you have to have an edge. You have to limit where you can cut properties in and cut properties out. So an edge is like a cookie cutter. And once you stamp it, you drive into a neighborhood, you get a feeling that you're stepping back in time and that you have to follow this edge. Well, Alloway has one of the oldest settlements between Lake Michigan and the Pacific Ocean. Doesn't have an edge. It has layers. A completely different format than what you guys are used to. Alloway is unique. It's special. The layering, well, 200 years of layering that we have on our housing stock is evident in our river zoning map.
But Jim, it has to meet the National Register criteria. I'm not doubting the history of the neighborhoods.
Today, we're still using the layers from 200 years ago when they were fur traders. It's on our zoning map. Private claims, they're still there. They make the basis for our county mapping system. So we have a mapping system that is completely different than the rest of the country because we have what's called private claims and everybody else has the grid system. And we have layers, and we started off with farms. Then we got the trolley system. We got a transportation system coming in. And then we got subdivisions. And we have a story that makes us a historic suburb, and that format. And the only reason I know this is because when this all started, I looked into it, and the National Park Service is one of their best manuals, as you talked about, dozens of manuals, one of their best ones that they label as one of their very best is the one on historic suburbs. And that's what I was asking Ms. Ford to follow is, look at this manual. We should evaluate our community based upon the best service, the best manual produced by the National Park Service, which is this historic suburb. I'm not a Victorian community like Astor Park and like Broadway and De Pere, which was from the 1880s and 1890s. We're from 1893 to 1963. That's a great story for us, and that's what we have. And again, my request was for you not to come here, for us to just turn our information over to the National Park Service and have them decide whether they want to do a case study for us. Because I have the list of the list here from the field notes that were typed up, and we don't have the original field notes, but they sent me their field notes. I do have
Jim, that was never on our agenda to look at that at all. So that might have been something that you had been working on, but we were never looking at going directly to the National Park Service.
Well, that has been my request since this thing came about.
We asked you if you had anything you wanted on the agenda to give it to us in writing, and you had never submitted anything. So we never did look at that. So I think that Joe had some answers for some of your questions. Joe?
Well, I remember at the start of the project, you brought forward the suburb bulletin. When we review survey products, we go out in the field with the consultant, drive the whole community with them, and it's with an understanding of all of these bulletins. It's not in our interest to deny projects to be eligible in the National Register, but we have to make sure they meet the requirements of the National Register. We did not feel that Alloway as a whole or any segment met the requirements of the National Register Bulletin on Suburbs. We did not feel that. I'm not downing the layout, the street patterns, the historic development of the community. That's a wonderful story. I'm not denying that. But it has to be in the National Register criteria. You have pre-statehood claims, the land claims. Well, if there's not an above-ground resource associated with that, the National Register is not going to say that that is historically or architecturally significant. That is not going to happen. Now, you could make a case archaeologically, maybe, but that was not the scope of this project.
I have a question.
Let me finish addressing it. Rita, can you give me a second?
Rita, I have a question first. When Jim is talking about the National Register with the historic suburbs, and the Historic Society has funded 101 surveys, were any of them looked at in that manner?
No.
And you did work with other suburbs, obviously, for suburbs of big cities.
Correct.
That may be developed in the same way that Alloway did?
Correct. And we have not identified any historic suburbs as being eligible for the National Register in Wisconsin. I'm not sure how many have been identified at the national level, but you could take a look at the National Register database online through the Park Service and see if there are any. I'd be surprised if there are many.
Could I ask
you,
Rita?
The people that live there have a right to say we do not want to be in historical district?
The process would be for a nomination to be prepared. It would be reviewed by my office, and then it would be scheduled for listing before the State Historic Preservation Review Board. That meets quarterly. When that meeting is scheduled for it to go before the Preservation Review Board, the property owners would be sent a letter informing them of this process, and they would be sent a letter that they would have to get notarized stating that they do not wish to have the district listed. If a majority of the property owners in that historic district notarize those letters and send them back to us, it does not get listed in the National Register. If a majority of property owners do not do that, though, and it meets the criteria and the review board approves
it, make it simple.
In pursuit of
Sunset Park will vote against it. They will.
Well,
and that's fine. I mean,
they don't. They will not want it.
Yeah,
and that's their choice.
That's fine.
So, just to be clear, now one of the big questions that I have was. The girl who authored the study, okay, so the assistant Angela Shearer authored the report, okay, who was the new hire and who wasn't on an approved contract, they wrote up this story on Heritage Hill, which is one of our treasures. We love it, and I want to see it survive. I want to see it thrive, and out of all the places that deserve...
Excuse me, Jim. Rita, we can't hear what Jim is saying.
Okay. Out of all the places that deserve extra attention and extra care are the resources that we have at Heritage Hill. And the National Historic Register should recognize the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, because there was a cemetery for Camp Smith from 1820. The first doctor killed on this side of Lake Michigan was buried somewhere up at this site. So they know that there's a cemetery there. There's an old fort cemetery there. And above ground is what we call the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which is in this report. And it said that doesn't count. They just dismissed it out of hand without even looking at it.
Jim, the thing is, moved properties are categorically excluded from listing in the National Register. So when you get properties such as Heritage Hill, where the bulk of the properties have been moved in from other locations, it makes them not eligible for listing in the National Register. Burial sites are excluded from listing in the National Register. There may be exceptions here or there, but by and large, burial sites are not listed in the National Register. And this is where I get back to the stories. They're very important and necessary to be told. The National Register has very specific rules and criteria for designation. And, you know, like Heritage Hill is a fine example of something. Yes, it is a treasure. It's not eligible for the National Register because it's the bulk of the buildings have been moved in there. It's an artificial setting of resources.
And so, just so we're clear, is that the start of Heritage Hill was the foundation for the courthouse that is now as a replica building put on there. But above ground, you can still see the old well from the courthouse from 200 years ago. So the old well is still there. It is marked with a marker from 1910 or 1920, whenever they put the marker there. So that is above ground. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier was put there when they dug the foundation for Cotton House, when that moved in, which was in the 1930s. So that has now been there for 50 years in and of itself. Even though it was originally a moved tomb, it is now older than 50 years old, and that as of by itself should qualify to be on the National Register.
I think the Cotton House is listed.
I'm talking about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which
Joe just told us that burial sites were excluded from the National Register. So that's why he's indicated that's why it's...
And the well that you mentioned, Jim, you know, the thing is, the resource has to be significant. So, you know, if it's the well associated with the courthouse, to me the courthouse is the important resource. If that's no longer there, you have a remnant. Doesn't mean that that remnant doesn't have a story, but is it significant? I would be hard-pressed to find why a well would be significant.
Okay, that's okay. And then I do have, you know, there's a section on a bulletin on cemeteries that should have been reviewed and that our board should be familiar with. So there, the bulletins, our board should be familiar with.
Yes, and Legacy Architecture has listed cemeteries in the past. They're difficult to list, but it can be done, and they have experience doing that. You mentioned the buildings with biositing that were added later on. Maybe I could shed some light on it. Typically, the way these surveys are done is the consultant does the survey. They drive each street in the community. They do not survey every building. They only survey buildings that are going to help them develop a context for the architectural character. So while they do drive every street, they're not photographing every building, although they do look at them. They will come up with an initial list of properties that I think are eligible for listing in the National Register, either by themselves or as part of historic districts. Once they come up with that, they get in touch with my office. We send staff up there to review these findings with them. And a lot of times, you know, they will have a district that might have 10 buildings in it, and we'll go, well, what about these buildings? They look like they may add. So they'll have to go back and resurvey those buildings to add those into the potential boundaries. So that's possible why things were added later on, and that is routine for surveys. The other thing that happens is this database is not only for use by the citizens of Alloway or people working on this project. For instance, there's a project going on by DOT on Riverside Drive right now. They're updating information in there. I get information sent to me literally on a daily basis, like the information that was sent on Beeble Construction. I changed that data that came into me. So it's not surprising to me that numbers have changed or information has changed from the initial survey, because information is constantly being updated. And as I said to you, if you provide me with the documentation and the information, I'll review it, and then we will update the information in the survey. But that hasn't happened yet.
So what you're talking about is the primary source documents for identifying who the builders were, for example. We should have had our best builders identified. And that information is very difficult to come by, but we should have had some sort of research done on the builders. Now, the best information that we had, in the way our town developed, was is that the builders would buy blocks of land, and so that is how you would find out who those builders were. But they didn't do any of the primary research into who the builders were. They asked our librarian, who got a list of one architect's properties. There was a second architect's properties came in, and then Steve's properties came in. So they only looked at three builders. And we had a lot more than three builders in our town. So that the primary source documents, they didn't go down to the county and look at the subdivision maps to see who was building what. My understanding is that they only spent a day or two at the library and used secondary sources and really didn't do primary research like I was thinking that they should have.
Well, if you have that information, by all means, send it to me, Jim. I've told you this repeatedly. And I have yet to get any of it. When I get it, then I will deal with it. I don't know what else to tell you.
Okay, Jim, before you continue, and since we're running short on time, I know that other people had sent in questions. Joe?
Yeah.
One of the things
there were questions that were sent in ahead of time that he's prepared to answer.
Thank you. Rita had sent in, Rita said that I believe that Legacy, that's the consulting firm, found that we had many, many homes that should be preserved, but they were not concentrated in one district. Before getting the grant, should that not be determined before we even get a grant? When Alloway was considering applying for the grant, they sent in a letter of intent to my office, and I came up and took a look to see if Alloway had enough resources to warrant a survey. And I said yes. You know, I didn't go into any detail other than you have historic resources here, it's worth doing a survey. We've had instances where I've been contacted about doing surveys, and I'll go there and the buildings are all screwed up. It's not worth doing. So I felt that, you know, we did look at, you know, you do have historic resources here, so we did look at that. The important thing was, again, the idea is to identify properties that are eligible for the National Register. It's not to get information on every building in town. It's only to gather information on the ones that are eligible for the National Register or in historic districts. Rita went on to ask, there should also be a discussion on what a district really is. And again, I mentioned if you want, you can go to the National Park Service website and look at bulletin number 15. It spells out what a historic district is. And I can read this here with you. It has the web link on the bottom. Again, a district possesses a significant concentration of buildings, and the key being significant. And then I went on to say that your real historic district from the 1820s is gone. And while that may be true, we do give grants to do archaeological surveys The thing that they're looking for, though, is are archaeological sites, are they still intact? So, you know, if you have a historic trail from the 1820s, but it's been developed, paved, it may still be there. And we had a case down in Prairie du Chien where when they were doing a sewer project, when they ripped up the pavement, we were able to get in there and do an archaeological project. But short of that, it's going to be very difficult to document anything that's currently paved. But, you know, if you feel like you do have a lot of archaeological resources, I would encourage you to apply for funding to undertake that type of project. I was asked to talk about the qualifications of the Historic Preservation Commission. The standards for these are spelled out on our website under the Certified Local Government Program, and all that we say for a commission is that it has established a qualified Historic Preservation Commission by local ordinance. So how whatever that's defined in your local ordinance, as long as the group you have that is on the commission meets what's in your ordinance, that's fine with me. We provide training for Preservation Commission members once a year at our annual meeting. This coming year, it's going to be in Elkhart Lake. We also, on our new website, we have a link to it's sort of a training module for commission members. It's sort of a way to, if you have issues that you're unsure of addressing, you can click on it and you can read how to address those issues. So that's a training tool that's also available. And then I come by request and speak with commissions about issues that they have. So those are the training possibilities that are available. So those were the questions that I was sent ahead of time. I think I've answered all of these. And just one last time, the focus of the survey was to identify National Register properties. They have to meet the criteria for that. If they do not meet the criteria for doing that, they do not get surveyed. They do not get put in the database. So that's the key of this.
Joe, yeah. I want to thank you for coming.
Well, thank you.
I want to thank you for your
Before
time.
You leave, guys,
and
still
I think it's very generous of you to give us this much of your time. And it isn't every speaker that has to raise his hand to answer the question when he's been here to present the facts.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, it doesn't do me any good to turn down properties for a listing in the National Register. It's an honorific program. It's not a regulatory program. There are tax credits that are available to people, but it's largely an honorific program. And, you know, the thing is, if, you know, new information comes to light, we will address that like we do with any survey. But until that comes to me, I can't do anything about it.
Well, I'm speaking for myself as an individual. When the survey took effect, I had certain reservations and questions and concerns. And as the survey went on, I was keenly aware of them. But when I realized the criteria that you are working in and what your frame is that and what you're trying to accomplish, it's understandable.
Well, thank you. You know, I can also provide, Jim, if you'd like the Park Service to look at this, send me an email. I will send you Megan Brown's contact information. She is the CLG coordinator for the country. And but what's going to happen is she's going to ask me how this was done. And I'm going to tell her it's been done according to the standards we've done for years. And we are waiting on further information from you. So, but feel free to give her a call.
Steve had one final question of me. And I said that the contractor was making up housing styles that were not in your database. And they put them in our report, And I couldn't find that particular style on the National Register or on your register. And that particular style was on the house right next to the Vince Lombardi house. It's something called a mansard house. I know what a mansard roof is, but it was described as a mansard house. And then they drove through, and I happened to be, have the listing on as a realtor. I've been through all these houses. They picked out one of my listings as a mansard house. And so I looked at it. I've been tracking, trying like the Dickens to find out exactly what a mansard house is according to the National Register and to the state, and you don't have it anyplace. So,
Jim,
my question is, what is a mansard house, and why is it in our report?
Jim, is that something that you can send an email to Joe to?
No,
we had asked for questions in advance. If he had gotten the questions in advance, he would have been more prepared. He would have been able to probably answer all of your questions this evening.
I'm not an architectural historian, so I'm not, you know, I don't dabble in architectural styles. I do know that the National Park Service and my office is developing style classifications for architecture constructed after the 1950s. Currently, it shows up in our database as contemporary, which tells us absolutely nothing. In the past few years, we've added ranch style to it. But we're in the process of developing new classifications for modern architecture, and maybe that's where it came from. We're at the front end of studying modern architecture, and a lot of these things haven't been identified at the national level yet. Wisconsin has been a leader, though, in our database and our office operations as a whole. So it will not surprise me if the Park Service comes to us looking for, how are we going to classify these things? So we've been asking consultants to identify modern architecture. That's a part of the training that we provide. We've been focusing on post-war architecture over the last several years, and we're having them come up with classifications so that we can come up with, okay, what do we have out there? Because we don't know. So it doesn't surprise me that you have not found a mansard classification, because one hasn't been developed yet.
I just wanted to say thank you very much also. And like I said, I think that you're an honest guy. I think that there was some things that were done absolutely wrong here, and I'd like to get you the information. I give it to Steve in the village and to the the board here. But if, for example, you look at it and honestly say Jim was right, and that they did pollute my database, and we need to do something about it, what would the next step be?
Information is sent to me. I will verify it as best I can, and if it, you know, if it's accurate, I'll update the database.
But that's not enough. Let's say that, and that's not enough to just sweep it under the rug. We got bamboozled, and I would like to see somebody being reprimanded for this. If in fact it was done intentionally, and they should have known better.
Jim, if you have that feeling, you need to give documentation and information in regard to that specific people, specific issues, specific instances, and all the documentation behind it before we're even going to address it. And
well, that's what I brought it here. I brought it here with me today.
Him, yep, so that's great.
Okay,
and adopt Jim.
It is.
I mean, I'm not going to bind people if that's what you're asking for, and all I can say is I will update information that comes to me. If,
I was asking for a case study. Was what my
I don't know what you mean by a case study.
Well, I was told that the intensive survey
Jim,
is done and over, and I asked
Jim,
for a case study.
Jim, it's 6:30. It's past 6:30. We are trying to keep the meeting
the
to 6:30.
The thing to keep in mind is that the funding came through the Park Service, through my office, to be done by the standards developed by the Park Service as interpreted by my office. The village is free to do whatever they want with their own money, funding their own surveys, but if there's no involvement with the Wisconsin Historical Society, we will not stand by any recommendations for National Register listing, because that's the program that the Park Service has charged us with to administer. So that's the important thing to keep in mind. You can fund case study, survey, whatever you want to call it. If it's done in a vacuum, we're not going to live with the results. And we're the voice of the National Register in Wisconsin. Whether you agree with that or not, we're it.
It's not a threat. I respect, that's the way it is. I love the National Park Service. There's no government agency I like better than the National Park Service. I just have a disagreement with the way this survey, the methodology on the survey.
Okay. Do any of the other committee members have any questions for Joe DeRose? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is to set the meeting date for the next meeting and the agenda. The next meeting date is February 26th. And for the agenda, I've asked Mary Jane Herber to come in to speak to us about how she and the De Pere Historic Preservation Commission have gone about in identifying where we go from here with our intensive survey. How do we choose which properties to look at next? How do we notify the public? What direction we should start going in? So Mary Jane will be at our next meeting to let us know how they work through that in De Pere. And I think that's anything. We don't have any other announcements. That's it. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I make a motion.
Second.
Okay, a motion and a second have been made. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you.